Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and my voice is still affected. Last week it was perhaps even a little worse, I'm not sure. Maybe it didn't seem like it, but sure was worse over the weekend. So I'm feeling good, actually sounding pretty good compared to yesterday and the day before, and hopefully recovering well. There's no pain associated with this voice impairment. And therefore, if it sounds painful to you, it isn't. And we hope that you will not be inhibited from calling to talk as usual. If you have questions about the Bible and about the Christian faith, you can call me right here and we can talk about them. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090. And I just noticed we've begun the last week of February already. It seems like 2014 has just begun, and yet we're now in the final week of the second month. And for those of you who live near Santa Cruz and who participate in our gatherings or anticipate them and are eager for them to occur, they only happen about once a month at best, sometimes a little less frequently than that. But I will be, Lord willing, in Santa Cruz this weekend. We have a meeting. It's in a home. It's an open Q&A Bible discussion. It's what we've always done. And the location can be found at our website, thenarrowpath.com. If you live in that area or want to drive into that area, or fly in for that matter, feel free to do so. That's this Saturday night, 7 o'clock as usual. And meeting will be at Steve and Margie's house for those of you who've been there before. If you don't know where that is, you can go and find the location on our website, thenarrowpath.com, and that'll be found under the announcements link. So this Saturday night, which will be March 1st, we'll be once again in Santa Cruz and looking forward to seeing our friends there and maybe making some new friends as well that we've never met there before. Let's talk to Kim from Dallas, Oregon, first of all today. Kim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi there.
Hey, I got a question for you. I'm wondering, I've been listening to you for the last couple months, and it's helped me a lot in terms of understanding Israel, and I've been bothered for a few years about all the emphasis on the end times of Israel and rebuilding the temple as though God wants them to rebuild the temple, and your explanations that I've heard lately have really helped me get a better understanding. And the one thing I'm curious about is, had Israel obeyed the Old Covenant, and I'm assuming that Jesus would have still had to have come and died for the sins of the world, since all of the sacrifices and everything were a picture of those things in heaven. And then I'm wondering, then, had Israel or the Jews accepted Jesus for who he was, if the Gentiles then would, if there was a contingency plan that God had, or how Gentiles had the Jews, you know, followed Christ, what would have happened differently then? Because I have the impression from Romans that the Gentiles were able to receive Christ because of the Jews not receiving him somewhat. So I'm just curious if you have thoughts on that for me.
Well, the gospel going to the Gentiles was somewhat affected by the Jewish reaction against Christ, in that, the persecution of the Christian movement in Jerusalem and by the synagogues in different lands often propelled the gospel to go to new regions, Gentile regions, where it was preached. And therefore, the hostility of the Jews toward Christianity could be seen as having had a beneficial role in some ways in the spread of the gospel to the Gentiles. Although, of course, we could argue if there had been no such persecution, that gospel probably would have gone still out to the Gentiles eventually, maybe not as quickly, because Jesus had told the disciples to go to all the nations. But it's true, until persecution broke out, they were pretty complacent to stay in Jerusalem and to just enjoy, the fellowship there. Now, as far as what would have happened if Israel had not rejected Christ, we have to understand that Israel didn't necessarily reject Christ. A remnant of them did not, and some did. Now, that remnant was the disciples, of course. All the early followers of Christ were Jewish. They were all part of Israel. But they were, as in the days of the Old Testament, there was only a remnant of Israel that was ever faithful to God or ever heeded God's prophets or ever kept covenant with God. And that being so, it was that way predictably at all times. It would be very unlikely that every last Jewish person would be faithful to God. As long as people have free will, there'd always be some rebels, just like there would be in any other race of people. But a portion of the Jewish people did receive Christ, and there's nothing that would have prevented that portion from being larger. It wouldn't have spoiled anything. In other words, let's say, just for the sake of having a figure, let's say 10% of the people of Israel in the first century received Christ. I think the percentage was probably smaller, but let's just go with that. Now, what if it had been 20% or 30% or 40% or even 70% or 80%? There would still be a few. There would be some that that did not receive him as well as some who did. And so there would always be some in Israel, I mean, unless 100% received Christ, which does not seem very likely for any ethnic group, you know, there would always be some of Israel that received Christ and some that didn't. So it's kind of a mistake to say that Israel didn't. We can say that the leaders of Israel and the majority of the people of Israel did not receive Christ. But that majority could have been smaller. It could have even been a minority that rejected him. In fact, it could have even gone down to the leadership merely rejected him, and all the peasants could have accepted him. But because the leadership rejected him, he would still have gotten himself crucified. But if every last Israelite, including the leadership, had received Christ, then there still would have been the transition from the old covenant to the new, because Jesus came to bring a new covenant, which was predicted by Jeremiah and the Old Testament prophets. And so there would be an improvement over the old order, even if the Jews had spearheaded the acceptance of Jesus throughout the world. If the Jews had, to a man, had all received Christ and become his disciples, there still would have been the passing of the sacrificial system and its replacement by a new covenant. Now, but how would Jesus have gotten crucified if everyone in Israel had accepted him? Yeah. Well, there are others. To tell you the truth, if everyone in Israel had accepted him, God would not have had to use the Jews to turn him over to the Romans. The Romans would have taken him out of fear of his influence, no doubt. At least that's a reasonable assumption. The Jews themselves, the Sanhedrin, was afraid that Jesus was so popular among the Jews that the Romans would, you know, interfere because of his influence. Now, if he was followed by all the Jews, then the Romans would be even more concerned, I would think. And it's the Romans, not the Jews, who crucified people. So I think, you know, I mean, the Jews are blamed in the Bible with the crucifixion of Christ in some measure, but that's because they turned him over to the Romans. But the Romans crucified him. Jesus could and probably would have been, almost certainly would have been crucified, even if all the Jews had been favorable toward him, I think. That's my assumption.
And then you think, therefore, that the gospel would have gone to the Gentiles either way, then, really. It didn't really matter whether or not.
Well, the Gentiles, the Gentiles were evangelized by Jewish believers. So if the whole nation of Israel had become believers, there'd be a lot more Jewish believers to evangelize the Gentiles.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Kim, good talking to you. Thanks for your call.
You'll see.
All right, God bless you. Our next caller is Don from Salem, Oregon. Don, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
You've received some calls asking about purchasing Bibles. And I have on my lap now a Bible I bought 20 years ago. And I have to keep stuffing Ephesians back in it, and the back is broken, and I decided that maybe it's time to buy another Bible. And I'd like to make some recommendations.
You would like to make some, or you'd like for me to make some?
Yeah, there's, since I thought I'd, this one was pretty well worn, I'd buy another Bible, and I've had an experience in that in the last few months. I like David Jeremiah's sermons and approach to the scriptures, and he's, I believe that you had somebody call in and talk about buying one of those. I didn't hear that.
No, it must have been on another program. I don't think anyone's called to talk about the Jeremiah Study Bible, but I would say that when we talk about buying a Bible, it's one thing to buy a Bible. It's another thing to buy a study Bible. A study Bible is a Bible plus the notes and commentary of somebody else.
Exactly.
Right. Now, I don't particularly recommend any study Bibles because I don't recommend that we mix the opinions of any man with the scriptures themselves in our Bibles. I'm not saying it's a sin. I'm just saying it's not something I would recommend. I'd rather open my Bible and find only the words of God there and not the words of God on part of the page and the words of some man on the other part. But if you're looking to a man to tell you what the Bible means, then there are a lot of study Bibles out there, and I don't know which I would recommend because almost all of them, not every last one, but almost all of them are written by dispensationalists, and that would include David Jeremiah and Charles Ryrie and Schofield and most study Bibles. And there are some exceptions, but for the most part, if you're going to get a man telling you what the Bible means, it's because what he's going to tell you is something you wouldn't get from just reading the Bible itself. You see, I wouldn't put my notes in the Bible for someone else because I believe they can read the Bible themselves and see the same things I'm seeing. But if I felt like I had to, you know, I had some beliefs that you couldn't really find in the Bible without my guidance, then I might be tempted to put my notes in the Bible. And that's what I think is the case with dispensationalist study Bibles. You can't really find those doctrines in the Bible itself, so you need somebody to put his notes in there to tell you to see them there. And I don't recommend that. I think a man is better off with just a Bible. Now, you know, there's nothing wrong with reading commentaries. I read lots of commentaries. And if you had a Jeremiah study Bible and you put it on your shelf and along with perhaps other commentaries, you consulted it. I have, for example, a John MacArthur study Bible on my shelf. John MacArthur is a dispensationalist. I have a Schofield a reference Bible. He's a dispensationalist. And I have some commentaries by people who are dispensationalists. I also have commentaries by people who are not dispensationalists. But the point is with a commentary, when you open a commentary, you know you're about to read what some man thinks about the Bible. And you come to it with a little different kind of an attitude than if you're coming to the words of God in the Bible itself. So I generally speaking, for any Bible that I would use for study or for general reading, I would not have some man's notes in them. But that's my choice. I mean, other people can make different choices if they prefer.
You want to hear what I have to say?
Well, I'm not sure. How quickly can you tell me? I was having a hard time getting to your point, but go ahead.
Okay. I haven't disagreed with anything. The study Bible is a commentary. I recognize that. But you get different commentaries. And I was going to comment about that. I would say that in purchasing a Bible, a person should take, I would say go into a Bible bookstore and spend at least an hour there. And if you're going to give a study Bible, you are going to get these different views. And I don't agree with them. This is David Jeremiah Bible. I tried to find out some of his comments on Acts 2:38 and wanted to hear what his commentary was. And the person answering the phone didn't have the Bible, so because I like much of what he has to say and it sounded like I had material on the Bible, I went ahead and purchased it. And I would have called this a pig in a poke by. I don't appreciate it as much as the old one that's pretty well wore out here.
Okay, Don, what's the bottom line here? I'm not picking up what your message is to our readers here, our listeners, I should say. I guess they're readers too if they're going to read a Bible. But I mean, you're telling me something about your experience with the Jeremiah Study Bible, and that's fine. But I'm not sure what it is you're recommending. What is it? You're saying spend an hour in a bookstore?
I'm recommending that they check out the Bible that they're going to get. What is the purpose? Do they want to set it on a coffee table to impress people when they come into the home? Or do they want to use it to study? And
okay, Don. Well, I appreciate that. I think most people, when they're buying a Bible, actually, when they look at a Bible, they are thinking almost unconsciously about those things. I mean, if a Bible looks like an old-fashioned telephone book and weighs a ton, they probably won't be thinking about buying it unless they want it on the coffee table. My comments, I think, would pretty much still stand, that I think it's best to just get a Bible, a good translation of the Bible, preferably. And then if you buy study Bibles as well, don't use those as your main reading Bible. Put those on your shelf as commentaries and pull them out when you need to consult different people's opinions about things. And I would suggest just doing it that way would cause you to have an attitude toward the study Bible that you should have. That is, it's a commentary that you pull out occasionally when you can't understand something yourself. And then you evaluate what the commentator says in light of Scripture. And you don't consider that to be the Bible. You consider it to be the commentator's views. Anyway, I'm really not 100% sure what you were calling about, but I appreciate the chance to get some of those thoughts out. Let's talk to Bob from Tampa, Florida next. Bob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for taking my call. I was in Bible study yesterday, and a person there mentioned that we're actually not under the new covenant. And I was sort of taken aback by that comment. I spoke with him later, and he said that we're ministers of the new covenant, but we're not actually under it, that it's for the future. Have you ever heard of that? If so, can you?
Well, once again, I think we're looking at a dispensationalist here who, not all dispensationalists would say it the same way, but I think the people who say that normally would be dispensationalists. They believe that there is going to be a new covenant that God will make with Israel that he's not yet made. Or maybe it's not even so much, it certainly isn't mainstream dispensational. It could be more in the messianic movement, that God has yet to do something with Israel, which will be making the new covenant with them. And they base this on the fact that Jeremiah 31:31 says that God will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. And they say, well, look, that hasn't happened yet. Most of the house of Israel and the house of Judah are still unbelievers. They don't believe in Christ. Therefore, God has not yet instituted that new covenant. And they misunderstand. They think that the house of Israel and the house of Judah means every last Jew, apparently, because Jesus was up in the upper room with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. That is the believing remnant of them, his disciples, and he instituted the new covenant. He said, this cup is the new covenant in my blood. Take it, drink it, and so forth. And he very clearly was instituting the new covenant with the remnant of Israel that were there in the upper room with him. It's true that not all the Jews have come to believe in Christ, but I don't believe there's any place in the Bible that predicts that they will. And the prophecies in the Old Testament, the promises God made to Israel, again and again, the prophets say that this will be with the remnant of the house of Israel. There's probably no one who made more promises or recorded more promises of God to Israel than did Isaiah. And yet Isaiah says in Isaiah chapter 10, though the children of Israel be like the sand of the seashore, only a remnant will be saved. So this is common message in the prophets. There's a remnant, a faithful remnant, that God will do these things for. And Jesus did that in the upper room with the faithful remnant who were called his disciples.
Well, I've just never heard this before. I think when I look at Hebrews, it talks a lot about the old covenant passing away, and it seems that my dispensational friends are happy to say that we're not under the Old Testament law, but we're under the law of Christ. It seems to me that, I don't know, it's almost like there's some in-between zone that we're in that's pretty ill-defined. I personally think that Christ instituted the new covenant. We're under the law of Christ now.
Yeah.
He's our high priest, etc. And I was astonished because I have a lot of dispensational friends that will say, talk about the seven-year tribulation, etc. But I've never encountered anybody that made a very firm point about we're not being under the new covenant at this present time.
Dispensationalists don't all say the same thing, but all of them do seem to think that the church is kind of a parenthesis, that God's main dealings are with Israel, and that the church is in kind of a never-never land between God's old covenant with Israel and God's new covenant with Israel, and that we're just kind of in there, like a spacer, something taking up space until God gets around to making that new covenant with Israel. I think the whole system is flawed. And certainly Ephesians does not indicate that the church is an afterthought or parenthesis, but rather that it's God's eternal purpose and it's the fulfillment. The whole New Testament teaches that the body of Christ is the fulfillment of the promises that God made to Israel. So I'm not really sure why they would hold that view. You're right about Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 8 and verse 13 says where a new covenant is, the old has become obsolete. Now, he says that which has become obsolete is about ready to vanish away. So what has become obsolete? The old covenant. Why? Because there is a new covenant. And he says that which has become obsolete is ready to vanish away. So obviously the new covenant has come and made the old obsolete. That's the plainest meanings of the words. A lot of times, although dispensationalists claim that they're taking the literal interpretation of Scripture, and that others do not, they claim. The truth is, they go non-literal as often as they need to. And, a very literal interpretation of Hebrews 8:13 says the new covenant has come and the old covenant has vanished away, or was vanishing away at the time that it was written.
Well, I don't think I'm going to be able to convince my friend. He seems very settled in his views and quick to suggest that if I disagree, I'm not being biblical.
That's a shame, because he probably got his views from a particular teacher or a particular pastor. I don't think you'd get them just from reading the Bible. And I'd like to think that all Christians, whether they hold my views or someone else's views, are searching the Scriptures to learn, to understand the Scriptures better. But some people aren't. Some people they've just learned something from the first teacher they ever heard. They said, that sounds good. I like him. Makes sense to me. Don't bother me with any other possibilities. Even though, whether they know it or not, some other view has been held by the vast majority of thinking Christians from the time of Jesus till now. But that doesn't matter. If the view they hold makes sense to them, that's enough. It never occurs to them to be humble and to think, maybe I'm not smarter than all the other Christians who've ever lived. Maybe some other Christians who think otherwise might be as intelligent as I am, and might be searching the Scriptures as diligently as I am. And maybe I should ask what it is they think they see there. You see, we can't really learn anything new unless we consult with people who already know things we don't know. That means they don't see things our way at the moment. And so we definitely need to be consulting each other. We need to be listening to each other. We don't have to believe each other, but we do have to hear each other and judge whether the things being said are more scriptural than what we've already thought. I do that all the time, and I think any Christian should. I think that's the only way you grow.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks a lot, Steve.
Okay, Bob. Good talking to you.
Likewise.
Thanks for your call. Okay, John from Greenfield, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling and waiting.
Hey, Steve. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Sounds like you're finding a little colder, huh?
I've got a bit of a cold in my throat, yeah.
Okay. I'll keep you in my prayers there. Just a quick question for you, and you probably discussed it the last couple of weeks, maybe a couple of months, where it's kind of been a hot topic in reference to the four bloodlines coming and the significance of it. And I guess it's happened before three other times, recently. So I'm just kind of curious, what's your thoughts? Scriptures and whatever it may be, I'll take my answer, off the radio here. So,
okay, John, thanks for your call.
Thank you, Steve. Have a
mm-hmm. Bye. Bye now. What is my reaction to all the furor over the four blood moons? I'm not very excited about it. Frankly, I don't know that it means anything at all. I've lived a long time, though. And I've seen a lot of people pointing to current events and things, signs in the sky and so forth, which they believed were signals of the immediate coming of Christ. So far, they've all been wrong. Maybe someday someone's going to be right. But it's sort of like when someone cries wolf a whole bunch of times and there's no wolf. Then when they finally do cry wolf and there is a wolf, no one's going to know that they're telling the truth. And that's where we stand right now. There's been one teacher after another through my lifetime, but more so through the whole history of the church, who's had this little scheme to show that this time, his time, was very significant and was very much pointing in the direction of the end and the coming of Christ and so forth. And frankly, I'll tell you what I think about that. First of all, there have been about 1,000 people who've done that probably. And so far, the only thing they have in common with each other is they've really all been wrong. Now, if the people who are talking about the blood moons are right this time, and if Jesus maybe is coming really soon, that's wonderful. I'm looking forward to it. Let him come. What am I supposed to change? Why am I supposed to be concerned about this? What is the practical response I'm supposed to have? Suppose I had every reason to believe that the material in these books and talks about the blood moons is really, really significant, and this really is pointing to this being the time when Jesus is going to come back in the next year or so. Okay, fine. I can't imagine anything I would do differently than I'm doing now. And, I don't know what anyone else should be doing differently. If Jesus is coming back, let us say this year, just for the sake of picking a time that's not too far off. If Jesus is coming back this year, what should I do? Well, whatever that answer to that question is what I should do now, whether he's coming back or not. When he comes back, Jesus said, "Blessed is that servant whom he finds doing the thing he appointed him to do." Now, if the servant says, "My Lord delays his coming," and begins to eat and drink with the drunkards and beat his fellow servants, well, that servant's going to be surprised when his master comes, and very unhappy too, because he'll be cut in two and given his place to the hypocrites, Jesus said. But why would anyone want to do that if they really believe in Jesus? If people believe in Jesus, they're following him. If they're Christians, they're following Jesus. If they're following Jesus, what more could be asked of them? We certainly can't ask them to be aware of the day and the hour of Jesus coming, right? I mean, how there's nothing in the Bible that tells us we should know when he's coming. There's not even anything in the Bible that tells us that we should know necessarily that he's going to come soon. Paul and others in biblical times talked as if they hoped he might come soon. They apparently didn't know about these blood moons. They should have, because then they wouldn't have thought Jesus was coming so soon in their time if they knew these blood moons were supposed to be coming as a sign first. I personally think it's another gimmick. And I think it's just as much of a gimmick as Harold Camping a few years ago, or as Edgar Wisenot. Oh, you don't remember him. Back in 1987, he published a book called 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Be in 1988. It didn't happen, you might have noticed. And so he put out another book, 89 Reasons That Jesus Will Come Back in 1989. Well, he missed that one, too. There have been no more books forthcoming from Mr. Wisenot, but there have been from Harold Camping and from others. And even if they don't set the exact date, one thing they've all been right about, one thing we can say that they all have in common, is that they have proven that no one knows the day or the hour, and that we should just be following Jesus. See, I don't have any assurance that Jesus is coming back in the next 5 years or in my lifetime. I would love it if he did, and if it turns out that somebody is onto something here. John Hagee's got it right, and Jesus is coming back soon. Well, fine, that's okay. I've been ready for him for the past 40 something years. I'm ready for him now. I was ready for him then. I don't have to have an opinion about when he's coming, as long as he finds me occupied in the thing he's told me to do. So. I guess when people want to talk all about, oh, Jesus is coming soon, there's these evidences that something significant is going to happen prophetically. I guess the question I always want to ask them, and what does that mean to me or you? What are you going to do differently? And why? Why are you going to do it differently? If someone says, well, I've just read this book about the four blood moons, I've decided Jesus is coming soon, so I'm going to get right with God. Well, fine. Get right with God, with my blessing. You should have done it before. Why did you need a book like that to do it? Didn't you know there was a God before? Didn't you believe Jesus is going to come? Didn't you believe someday you're going to die and face God? It doesn't even matter if Jesus comes back in my lifetime. I'm going to die, and so are you. So why should I care? I'd love it if Jesus came back, but I don't have any time to be thinking about new schemes about how near his coming is. It's just not, it doesn't interest me like it did when I was a kid. What interests me now is working towards seeing God's purposes in the church fulfilled and in the world, and doing that just as much as if I felt he wasn't going to come for a century. And some people maybe don't have any sympathy toward that attitude, but frankly, that's the only attitude that makes sense to me. So those are my thoughts on the blood moons. Let's talk to Tim from Federal Way, Washington, and we have a line open for you. You're listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. I'm a little hoarse today, but that's okay. Well, we can get through this. And if you have a question, you can call me at 1-800-438-5090. Tim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. How are you today, other than your voice?
Reasonably good, thank you.
Good. Hey, I'm with a Bible study, and we're going through the Book of Acts and just starting it. We came upon the passages about Ananias and Sapphira.
Yeah.
And we were discussing that, and we kind of went down the road that there might have been extra information about their situation that might not be in the Bible. And I made the comment, well, we'll just have to wait until we get to heaven and we can ask them ourselves. And I was kind of set back because I was surprised that the consensus with the rest of the Bible study was that Ananias and Sapphira probably won't be there in heaven. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that, and I can take your answer off the air.
Okay, Tim, thanks for your call.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's been one of the insoluble controversies about Ananias and Sapphira. We aren't told whether they were Christians or not. We're told that they were in the church. Now, for people who believe that being baptized and being in the church makes you a Christian, then I guess they'd be called Christians. But I personally believe there's lots of people in the church, some of them baptized and many of them professing to be Christians, who don't have a clue what it means to be a Christian. They've never heard the gospel clearly or understood it or responded to it fully, and they're in the church for reasons other than the reasons I'm in there. Whatever their reasons may be, I can't say, because I don't know. But they are not Christians, and you can tell by their lives. They don't have Jesus ruling their lives. They're not submitted to his lordship. And by biblical definitions, that makes them not what the Bible calls Christians. They're not disciples. Now, Ananias and Sapphira might have been of that class. They might have been people who were not really Christians, or they might have been real Christians. The interesting thing is we're not told. It's possible that Peter himself didn't know. Maybe he felt he couldn't make that kind of judgment. But we also don't know, let's say, if they had been Christians, we don't know if they had committed an act so heinous that that would have had a negative impact on their salvation. One thing we know is they suffered a temporal judgment. They dropped dead. Of course, that's something that every Christian does eventually. Everyone drops dead eventually. The fact that God causes some people to drop dead on the spot in certain situations does not increase their mortality rate. It just moves it forward. The same thing when Uzzah touched the ark and he was struck dead, or any other situation like that in the Bible. These are not cases that tell us where these people went for eternity. These are cases of God simply showing us that he was going to express in a supernatural way his total distaste and disapproval for the behavior and going to make an example of them. If I didn't get enough sleep foolishly because I stayed up too late talking to people, and then I made a long drive at night and I fell asleep at the wheel and I got killed in an accident, one could argue that that's an example to other people not to drive when they're not adequately awake. It doesn't mean I went to hell. It does mean that God did not preserve me from death when he could have. He could have had angels around the car keep me from dying, but he let me die. Who knows? Maybe for an example so others would learn. I don't know. Who can say why? In this case, with Ananias and Sapphira, we know that they definitely were made an example. But whether they went to hell or not, we don't know. I'm not necessarily convinced that they weren't Christians. Christians do make big mistakes sometimes. I know, because I'm a Christian, I've made some real big mistakes. And if I had died as a result of those mistakes, I think I still would have been, would have gone to heaven, but I would have died shamefully and, perhaps been an example to other Christians not to make those mistakes. So I'm not able to answer, because the Bible doesn't give us anything like information about that. The Bible doesn't tell us if they were real Christians, if they suffered eternal consequences as well as temporal ones. And, some people say, well, you're not going to see them in heaven. Well, we just don't know that. We don't know that to be the case. Your conversation with your friends reminds me of a story I heard about an antagonistic school teacher trying to give trouble to one of his Christian students, and said, do you believe that the Bible's literally true? And the student said yes, and he said, well, what about that passage that says that Cain knew his wife? Where did his wife come from? God just made Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel. Where did his wife come from? And the student said, well, I don't know, but when I go to heaven, I'll ask him. And the teacher said, well, Cain wasn't a very good man. Probably you're not going to see him in heaven. And she said, well, then you can ask him. But this is a little different situation, because the people who said that they're not going to see Ananias and Sapphira in heaven are probably Christians. And so if Ananias and Sapphira are in hell, they may not be able to ask him. But if we can't ask him, it'll be unnecessary for us to ask. You know, I mean, if they're not in heaven, we'll know why. But we don't know if they're going to be there or not. We just don't have enough information about some of these things, and so they become points where Christians could have disagreement without being unfaithful to what we know, because we know too little. Let's talk to Joe from Las Vegas, Nevada. Welcome to the Narrow Path, Joe.
Well, thank you, Steve, and I hope you start feeling better. Been listening, and I do have a question on the third epistle of John.
Yeah.
I'm going to give just a little background, then I'll ask my question. My background is, as I think I've told you some time ago, is I was what they call a cradle Catholic, and I was raised up in the Catholic Church, and you know, the teachings of the Church is that Peter was the first pope.
Yeah.
And so I have been, much to the chagrin of my family, as I've gotten older, I have went into more of a Protestant point of view as far as looking at the scriptures. And so I asked them, I said, well, what do you do with John 3, particularly in verse 10? And they said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, if the church has been around since St. Peter, because the Catholic Church, and I was raised that way, I was taught that St. Peter is was the first pope. I have an uncle who is a Catholic priest, and I said, it seems that John is giving the business to his followers that don't even bother with as an ends here and put some out of the church. And I told him, I said, you know, you can't have it both ways, folks. You know, if the church is the Catholic Church, then the Catholic Church is doing something that St. John and his disciples, apparently, they wouldn't let them, you know, come into the church. So my question is, I told him, I said, I don't think the Catholic Church was around till maybe around 300, based on what I, give or take a few years. And the church that he's talking about is us, the church that believed in Christ during that time. Did I tell them right? How do you view these scriptures? Do you see it the same way? Do you understand what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I do, actually. I see it very similarly. For those listeners who don't know what 3 John verse 10 says, John is talking about a man named Diotrephes. And in verse 9, he says that Diotrephes loves to have the preeminence among the church, but he does not receive John and John's companions. Now, who is this Diotrephes? It says in verse 10, therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds, which he does, prating against us with malicious words. And not content with that, he himself does not receive the brethren and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church. Beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. And now, the picture we have here is this man, Diotrephes, has some kind of leadership role in the church, but he's not worthy of it, but he nonetheless has that position. He loves the preeminence, but he clearly is out of sync with God and the apostles, because when John sends letters and messengers to the church, this guy does not receive John's letters or his messengers, and if someone in the church does receive them, he kicks them out of the church. Now, that means that Diotrephes had some kind of power to throw people out of the church. He had that kind of influence, and yet he was by no means in sync with the apostles. Certainly, if Peter was overseeing that church, that is even remotely, if there's a hierarchy of bishops from Peter on down to that church, and Diotrephes was one of the recognized leaders, he certainly would Peter approve of rejecting John and John's messengers? Obviously not. One thing this makes very clear is that the churches were autonomous in their authority. They didn't answer to some central authority somewhere. Secondly, it shows that a church could gather and be under authorities that were unworthy to be authorities in the church, and that, you know, that were anti-apostle. And it's interesting, too, that John didn't say throw him out of the church and put so-and-so in his place. See, there's another guy named Demetrius that John mentions in this letter who was actually a good guy. He could have said, throw out Diotrephes and put Demetrius in there. But actually, it would appear that the only thing John says is imitate Demetrius and don't imitate Diotrephes. That is to say that church leadership in those days wasn't really political at its best. The kind of church leadership the apostles approved was that of example. The good examples in the church, they're the sheep, they're the shepherds you should follow. The bad examples, don't follow them. Now, it would appear that Diotrephes actually held some kind of recognized position in the church, but John basically said, ignore him and follow better examples than him. So it really raises questions as to how you could have the system in the first century that the Catholic Church claims was there, with Peter, you know, presiding over the bishops and the bishops over the local churches and so forth. This is a case which makes it very clear the local churches were autonomous, and leadership was more or less, at least as far as the apostles were concerned, was non-political. But we see Diotrephes beginning to assert political power in the church, throwing people out that he didn't agree with. So we can see that in the latter days of the first century, the church which the apostles had established was beginning to be corrupted by leaders who were putting themselves in political power. And rather than John saying, okay, put Demetrius in political position, throw Diotrephes out, John maintained the form of leadership that Jesus recommended. And that is, leaders are good examples. Follow the example of the good and don't follow the example of the bad. And it's interesting that he didn't do more to discipline Diotrephes. But I agree with you, this does not look like a kind of setup in the churches that the Roman Catholics claim was there in the first century.
Yes, and thank you for that. And I did not see that. That was very good of you recognizing that. And I didn't see that part where John says, because he didn't say, but I mean, he didn't say, well, you know, get rid of this guy. If John was, you know, the ultimate say that this is the way it's going to be, he didn't do that. He didn't tell them to replace. So that's very good. All right, Steve, thank you very much. I appreciate that clarification too. And I hope you feel better. God bless.
Okay, Joe, God bless you too. And actually, you know, I don't feel too bad. I just sound awful. I did feel bad for a few days last week, but I don't know if you ever have this experience, but you know, you get a sore throat for a few days and your voice isn't affected, and then the sore throat goes away and your voice goes with it. That kind of happens to me once in a while. And that's what I'm going through at the moment. The throat is not sore, but the voice is gone. David from Everett, Washington, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
My question is, we have some friends that we've known for a long time that are professing Christians. And then a few weeks ago, they tell us that they believe in Christian evolution. And I guess my first thought right out of my head was, well, that's not Christianity. And then, so I asked the local pastor about it, and he tells me, well, it's just what's in your heart. And that really left me kind of hollow and wondering for a real answer. I was hoping maybe you had one for me.
When they said Christian evolution, do they mean that they believe that God, in creating the animal and plant world, used evolution, but he directed it?
Yes, I believe so. We descended from apes, and that's all ordained by God. And that basically the whole Old Testament is an allegory to make sense of a world that people back then couldn't make sense of.
Well, first of all, I don't agree with that. I don't believe in evolution, but lots of Christians do. And they wouldn't necessarily be saying that the whole Old Testament is an allegory, but they might be thinking that Genesis chapter 1 is. I don't believe that it is. But there are a lot of Christians who think that it could be. And they obviously have some different presuppositions than I do. I think mostly they're influenced, they're intimidated by the claims of mainstream science that claim that evolution has been proven scientifically, and that Christians, in refuting it or in standing against it, are outside of the mainstream. Of course, Christians. Of course, Christians should be outside the mainstream in many respects, but they say that Christians are out of step with modern discovery, and the way things are represented sometimes to the public, and many Christians have been intimidated by this, is that if you are going to acknowledge science, you have to believe in evolution. If you don't believe in evolution, well, then that's just a religious position you're taking. So if you want to be religious, that's your business. You can believe in creation or in anything other than evolution that you want to. But if you're scientific, you've got to acknowledge evolution. Now, this is an oversimplified thing, because actually many evolutionists believe in evolution not because of science, but because of their religion of materialism, their religion of naturalism. That is, they believe in evolution not because there's really great evidence for it, or certainly not proof of it, but because they are materialists, and the only way a materialist or a naturalist can explain the rise of diversity is through evolution, because they don't believe there's a God or supernatural. So their religion of naturalism compels them to believe in evolution. The interesting thing is that your friends who are Christian evolutionists, although I think they're mistaken, they are holding to evolution in spite of their religious views. They probably believe the Bible is true, but they think they're interpreting it differently than you are, and that it's, they have the liberty as Christians to believe in God, to believe in Christ, even to believe in the Bible after a sort, but they could believe in creation or evolution depending on how they approach Genesis 1. The point I'm making is atheists and materialists are forced to believe in evolution by their religious convictions. Christians can believe whatever the evidence points to, because even if there was evolution, Christians could believe that God directed it. And our main concern is that God is our maker. You know, whether he used fiat creation, like I think Genesis 1 teaches, or whether he used evolution, God is still the source and therefore the owner of the creation. And that he sent his son Jesus and commands all men everywhere to submit to him. So Christianity could be true whether God used evolution or not. And therefore, we are not compelled by religion alone to believe a certain thing. We're actually free to follow the evidence where it leads. What many people don't know is that a lot of the scientific evidence points away from evolution and toward creation, much more after the order that you find in Genesis 1, taken in a more literal sense. But I am not a scientist, and I am therefore not able to synthesize the entirety of the scientific case for or against any proposition. All I know is that from what I've read of the evolutionists, who are, people like Dawkins, who are popularizing evolution, and what I read from the creationists, it sounds to me like the creationists have as much scientific evidence as the evolutionists do. They just don't get a fair hearing in the marketplace. So I think your friends may have been intimidated by the suggestion that if you don't believe in evolution, you're just out of touch with reality. So they try to conform the Bible to that, which is unfortunate, because they don't have to. However, it may well be that the majority of Christians alive today do believe in a divinely directed evolution. I know C.S. Lewis did, and I disagree with him. I disagree with him on that, as much as I admired him as a Christian writer. I think a lot of Christians have wrong ideas about some things, and that would be one of them. I'm afraid we're out of time, though, and I can't go any further with you. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to help us stay on the air, I suggest you go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and click on the link that tells you how to donate to the ministry. That's at thenarrowpath.com. And I'll see some of you in Santa Cruz this weekend. Lord willing, let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you. Thank you.